Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 750.
Today we hear from Brad, who says,
What's up with Westerns? I listened to a ton of writing podcasts, and they're almost never mentioned. Yet, they seem like one of the purest forms of storytelling. On Goodreads, you have to drill down two levels to the all genres list to even find them. At one point, Westerns dominated Hollywood, and Louis L'Amour's book sales alone are in the 300 million plus range. What happened to the genre? Was it too much of a good thing, or are there readers out there that are underserved? Have you ever written or thought about writing a Western?
Brad, that's a really good question, and I'm gonna have to preface this by advising you to take my answer with a salt lick, because it's been several years since I read up on the history of the Western genre, and so what I'm about to tell you is from memory, and it might not be entirely accurate. Westerns became the sort of basic American mythology. Greeks had Mount Olympus, we had the frontier. The American identity was forged in the West. It was forged in the West partly because of the Civil War. The Civil War so deeply fractured the American consciousness that it took the opening of the West in the aftermath of the Civil War to create a new foundational mythology that essentially replaced the foundational mythology of the Revolution. It's not that the Revolution got forgotten, but what it meant had become a bit of a sore point for everybody, especially for everybody south of the Mason-Dixon line. After the Civil War, a lot of folks from the South, and a lot of folks from the North, but especially a lot of folks from the South, poor white folks and freed slaves, headed west to the new territories to try to remake civilization sort of from scratch and find a way to make it work. Because the South had two major underclasses, where the North was an agrarian and then later an industrial civilization, and to a greater extent than anywhere else at the time really embodied the idea of the citizenry being the aristocracy. The South was always feudal. It was cut from a different cultural cloth, different people groups settled it, and slavery enabled the perpetuation of the aristocracy, not just upon the slaves, but upon the white working class, or the serf class is basically what they wound up being, through vast swaths of the South in the cotton economy. So once slavery was outlawed, and the South had been burned down, there was a lot of, well, what do we do now going on? Because suddenly there was competition with the poor white folks for labor in a way that there never had been before, or at least not in a way that was visible to them. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity going around. A lot of the estates had been burned to the ground. The landlords who were reasserting themselves afterwards treated everybody like shit. And people headed west, and sometimes north. So a lot of the foundational figures, the outlaws and the bounty hunters and the heroes of the West, were disaffected Southerners, white and black, who headed out west to make their fortunes. Now, at the same time, in Europe, you had the Napoleonic Wars going on, and this is where it gets really interesting. With the opening up of the West, the federal government was giving away vast tracts of land. If you had the price, the equivalent price of like a small car, like $15,000 in today's money, you could pack a wagon full of your family and all the stuff you needed to homestead, head out west for a while, stake your claim to 40 acres or 100 acres, I can't remember what the original grant was, and if you could prove out the land, then it was yours to keep forever. And by proving out the land, what you had to do is you had to be exporting cash crops from it in this is about either a 2 or 5 year window. Again, I haven't read the original Homesteading Act in a good while. But because the Napoleonic Wars were going on in Europe, two major things happened. First, you had an amazing flight of the educated classes from Europe into the East, who then, about half of them, filtered through to the West. We're talking not peasants, we're talking the upper crust who were refugees from the war. They could afford to come across and then had the money to raise it to establish themselves to go further west. And a well-run operation could take a family from poverty in the inner city in New York or Atlanta and have them be land barons on their own in about a year. It was the biggest explosion of wealth and raise up of the lower classes in history. And it was fueled by the famine that was created by the Napoleonic Wars. Europe couldn't feed itself. They needed American grain. So the West was this hugely multicultural place because you had the Germans and the French coming in from the Napoleonic Wars. You had the Chinese coming in from the Far East because they were also having trouble with the British in the Opium Wars. You had the freed slaves and the disaffected poor whites coming out from the South. It was the first real, aside from inner city New York, it was the first real cultural melting pot, and it became the new foundational myth of the United States. Endless opportunity. No one cared who you were. They cared what you did and how you behaved and what you owned. And the period of the open West only lasted about 10 or 15 years before the railroads came in and before barbed wire was invented, which caused the fencing off of the prairie. And that was basically the end of the westward expansion. But it had enough of an economic and cultural impact that by the time things turned septic, again, partly as a result of the Napoleonic Wars, there was a dispute over a gold claim in South Dakota that really started the Indian Wars. And that dispute wouldn't have happened, by the way, that's what the series Deadwood is about. That dispute wouldn't have happened had the United States not been already nearly bankrupt from the Civil War and then being called on to pay off debts to Europe that the Union had borrowed against during the Civil War in order to finance the Napoleonic Wars in an era where the only currency was gold. So the lack of gold basically caused the Indian Wars, the genocide that followed, and all of the awful stuff that came out of the West. But before that, there was this 5 to 15 year period, depending on what region you're talking about, when it was the open range, the limitless possibilities, true freedom, and you had the perfect situation for stories of good and evil, for stories of hardworking people and ruthless, greedy Easterners with lots of money who wanted to come in and snatch everything up. And, you know, the cattle barons versus the farmers versus the railroaders, you know, great archetypal stuff. And a lot of the people that lived through that era were still alive when the movies were invented. Wyatt Earp was a minor footnote in history until he got friendly with John Ford at a bar in Hollywood. And he got himself hired by John Ford on several of John Ford's westerns as an advisor. One of the people he mentored was a scrawny little kid named Marion, who took on the stage name John Wayne later on. Francis Marion was his original name, I think.
Thank God for his stage name, otherwise I would have grown up near the Francis Marion Marina.
Of course, the hilarious part of that is Francis Marion, by the standards of the day, sounds kind of effeminate, and John Wayne spent his whole life trying to hide the fact that he was bisexual. But that's a whole other... Anyway, the books about the Old West started during the Old West. The movie Unforgiven has a wonderful subplot with one of them, where Saul Rubinek plays one of the mythmakers of the Old West. The little penny dreadfuls that went around in London at this time were going around all over the U.S., but they weren't about monsters in the slums of London. They were about gunfighters and criminals and the people that were fighting for freedom in the West against the evil, oppressive Easterners. The term dude, by the way, means a Easterner who's a fish out of water in the West, which is a little hilarious considering what dude has come to mean. You know, it's sort of cool guy who's got it all together, or at least who thinks he's got it all together. But yeah, a dude ranch was originally a ranch that was set up by Easterners who didn't really know what the hell they were doing, so they had to hire locals.
Ranch tourism.
Well, and then it became ranch tourism later. But because of this foundational mythic quality and the fact that the movies were shot in Los Angeles, which basically looks like the West, because it is, you know, within a few miles of Los Angeles, you've got desert, you've got mountains, you've got sharp canyons, dramatic rock formations, the ocean, you've got all the
lizard people.
I think we're talking about different genres here.
Oh, right.
Anyway, you've got all the great scenery to make westerns, and so westerns were the cheapest thing to make, so Hollywood pumped them out by the thousands. And it was the other genres that were higher risk and higher budget. At least until Los Angeles got built up a little bit, and then crime movies became the other big genre. But that all started to change in the 60s, as production costs for other kinds of stuff came down, and we were in the space race, and nuclear bombs had been invented, and the world was interested in rocketry and supersonic flight and other stuff like that. And of course, World War II changed a lot of things in that regard as well. War movies were big for a while, but the real important downfall of the Western was the ascendancy of science fiction. Science fiction basically inherited all of the Western archetypal tropes and projected them into space. It's no coincidence that Gene Roddenberry pitched Star Trek as Wagon Train to the Stars. He wasn't just pitching it as a Western in space, he was pitching it as a specific Western in space. There was a series named Wagon Train. And he constructed the series to superficially look a little bit like the way Wagon Train was constructed in terms of its cast of characters. And he even hired DeForest Kelly, who was famous for his work in Westerns, to be one of the anchors on the show, to give a bit of a homespun voice to transition people into the new genre and make it acceptable. Because up till then, televised science fiction had all been basically horror. Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, all of them were the horror end of science fiction. And Star Trek brought the adventure end of science fiction to popular consciousness, and in some ways, that was all she wrote. Now, it took a little longer for the Western written genre to die off, and it took another 25 years for the film Western genre to die off, but the televised Western died off not too long after that, replaced by science fiction and spy series. What killed the Western off in the theater ultimately was Unforgiven. Although it was dying a very slow death, it had a resurgence in the 70s when the Italians got into the game, and that's when Clint Eastwood made the spaghetti westerns with Sergio Leone. And it had another brief resurgence in the 80s with more self-conscious meta-type westerns like Pale Rider, which was itself a commentary on the movie Shane, arguably the greatest western ever made, and Silverado, which was itself a distillation of all of the best western tropes into a sort of epitome that's hard to top. It had all of the best plot points from Rio Bravo and the Magnificent Seven and El Dorado all worked into a single film and beautifully done. Great movie, well worth seeing. And then, of course, Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood's final western, was itself a very effective attempt to demythologize the western. After that, it wasn't until the last 10 years, when Tarantino got into it and when the Coen brothers got into it, that the Western has seen a real resurgence with some fresh blood in it, a new generation, new consciousness, all that kind of stuff. What killed the Western off in the book world ultimately was the distribution collapse of the late 60s and early 70s. The readership had been going down, but it was still really solid. But unlike romance and science fiction and crime and horror, all of which had fan communities, westerns were so ubiquitous that there was no fandom. So when the distribution collapse hit, there wasn't a specialized culture trying to keep the flame alive. And so it didn't. The smart money went to those other genres. Science fiction was by then the biggest genre, romance was the second biggest, crime fiction the third, and over the years, science fiction has sort of sputtered out and become a distant third because of the popularity of films. Oddly, Star Wars had a lot to do with killing written science fiction, or at least taking it off of its top tier slot in the genres. So, Westerns are still around, and there is an underserved audience, but they don't have the mass popular consciousness in by that they used to. But that seems to be changing. Your question is not the first time this topic has come up within earshot of me in the last 3 years. Between The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and Django Unchained, and True Grit, and The Hateful Eight, and a bunch of other films in the last 5 or 6 years, Westerns are starting to make a comeback. Add that to the new Back to the Land movement, which, ironically, turns out I'm part of, even though I never planned to be part of a movement.
And don't forget television as well.
Has television been having a lot of Westerns? Oh, yeah, Justified.
Deadwood.
Deadwood. Right. I mentioned Deadwood earlier. I can't believe I forgot to mention.
There's a couple of Westerns on Amazon Prime and Netflix.
That's true.
That I think are originals to those
Longmire
shows.
Well, Longmire is adapted from a book series, but yeah.
And Westworld is a science fiction and a Western at the same time.
That's true. But the genre is coming back. A lot of people are wanting to write it again. A lot of people are wanting to read it again. I don't know if it'll ever hit critical mass, but I've got a theory as to why it's coming back. It is the foundational myth of America. In addition to all the stuff I talked about before, it's also the foundational mythic battleground. Because of the Indian Wars, because it was the frontier that first gave women the vote, because of the elbow room and freedom that it represents. Now that the Cold War is over, and not just over, but more than a generation over, and the world is finally catching up to the fact, Americans don't really know who we are right now. What happens when you don't know who you are as a person? Well, you start searching around for something to grab hold of. And a lot of people wind up going home to reground themselves and figure out where they came from and what it means in the context of who they've turned out to be. I think culturally, Westerns are starting to serve that purpose. There's a massive and very interesting cultural dialogue going on in the modern Westerns that are being made. That's what mythology does. And I think the hunger for that kind of regrounding is driving a lot of interest in Westerns. So if you like Westerns, I think you'll be able to find an audience for them if you want to write them. Now, the deck is stacked against you because it has been on the bottom as a literary genre for so long. But if you can figure out where to find your audience, maybe do promotion, advertising, public presence, piggybacking on new Western film releases and other stuff like that, you may be able to get your footing going. And genres explode from the ground up. They're not created from the top down. You know, like all things in the arts, there's only so much you can do to create a movement. You can create a flash in the pan pretty easily, but creating a sustained movement only happens from the ground up. Sometimes you get a flash in the pan that makes the spark, sets the fire. But usually, it's called a flash in a pan because it's contained by the pan. I mean, we didn't get a resurgence of disaster movies because of Titanic. In fact, Titanic was really the last successful film in a very brief resurgence of disaster movies in the late 90s and early 2000s. But you have gotten a long re-rise of science fiction. You have gotten a longer and much deeper and more sustained rise of crime fiction. And you're starting to see a re-rise of spy fiction because we're again in a world that seems to be dominated by spies, where for about 20 years, we even forgot that the profession existed. But now, post-Snowden, suddenly we're all very aware of how much spying really goes on, and we don't really know how to deal with it anymore, so how do you find out how to deal with it? Well, you write and consume espionage fiction. Unless you're a policy wonk, in which case you read a lot of geopolitical stuff and a lot of history about espionage, in addition to getting into spy fiction. Fiction is how we figure out how to handle the world around us, because it's bigger than all of us and none of us really has a lot of control over it. And Westerns are having another day. And given how long the current uncertainty is likely to last, I suspect that Westerns will have a long day. I don't know if it's going to be a big day or just a sustained moderate kind of day, but there probably is some really good money to be made and story territory to be explored in the Western genre. So, good luck. I've never really thought about writing one myself, but I don't quite have the bug, but I do love reading them. So, if you write them, send one my way. I'll give it a squint. It may be my thing. Either way, thanks for sending the question in, and I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.